122-0906 WC Employco USA Incorporated, appellant by Matthew Rakusik versus the Illinois Workers' Compensation Commission, Hector Del Bosque, appellee by Stephen Seidman.
Mr. Rakusik, you may proceed.
Good morning, counsel, Mr. Justice. My name is Matthew Rakusik, and I represent the Employco USA in the above captioned case. This is a disputed case on referral on appeal from the Illinois Workers' Compensation Commission. At the commission level, there were several issues in dispute. There are only two issues being presented to the court. These two issues address the question of average weekly wage and the question of whether the petitioner violated to the two physician rule set out by Section 8A3 of the Act. I'm going to address the two physician rule question first. It's the shorter of the arguments. I want to spend most of my argument talking about wage. Section 8A of the Illinois Workers' Compensation Act requires that an employer pay for all medical treatment for emergency medical care and for treatment relating to two choices of physician. And the courts, this court and the Supreme Court, has, when looking at the two physician rules, acknowledge what is called a chain of referral. One physician refers it to another, that stays within the same chain of referral. And the question in this case is whether there exists any chains of referral. The facts introduced in the record show that three providers provided medical treatment to the petitioner for his allegedly work-related injuries, or his now accepted work-related injuries. His first choice of the physician was Dr. Chorba, his primary care physician. This is not emergency medical care. Petitioner first saw Dr. Chorba 1 week after the accident on October 16th, 2018. There is nothing in the record to suggest emergency medical care anywhere. Dr. Chorba's records were introduced at trial. In those records, there is no references to any referrals made by Dr. Chorba to any of the other physicians in this case. Petitioners then chose to seek treatment at Illinois Bone and Joint Institute. He first sought treatment at Illinois Bone and Joint Institute on November 26th of 2018. The records introduced by petitioner from Illinois Bone and Joint Institute include patient intake history forms, where the petitioner was given the opportunity to list a referring physician. He did not do so. But on that very same form, the petitioner did identify Dr. Chorba as his primary care physician. Petitioner knew he could have knew about this form. He completed this form, but chose not to indicate Dr. Chorba was his referring physician. And none of the records from any Illinois Bone and Joint Institute physician indicates that the petitioner had been referred to that location by Dr. Chorba, the only prior physician in this case.
What's in Dr. Peterson's note?
I'm sorry, in whose note?
Dr. Peterson.
Dr. Peterson's notes, forgive me, Dr. Peterson, there is a Dr. Palinkovich from Suburban Orthopedics that does note a referral had been made, but no indication of who had provided a referral. And moreover, it was actually made to a doctor that was outside, was in the petitioner's third choice of physician.
Well, let me ask you a question. Dr. Peterson's notes, his name's Kyle Peterson, by the way. He records in his notes of March the 15th, 2019, that the primary care physician was Chorba. And according to the notes, patient was referred to Illinois Bone and Joint Institute. Referred by who? The only other doctor he saw was Chorba.
Your Honor, it is a petitioner's burden to prove who provided that referral. And
hold on a second. The commission gets to interpret these facts and determine what inference they choose to draw so long as it's reasonable. He saw Chorba on what date?
He saw Dr. Chorba October 16th of 2018.
And when did he have an MRI?
The MRI occurred shortly thereafter. Forgive me, I don't have the exact date in front of me.
When did he first go to Illinois Bone and Joint?
November 26th of 2018.
All right. So how much time is between the time he saw Chorba last and the time that he went to Illinois Bone and Joint?
Just a matter of weeks at most, Your Honor.
And where would Peterson get the notion that he was referred to Illinois Bone and Joint?
It had to be from the petitioner because the records themselves are completely absent.
It certainly had to be. So who do you suggest referred him if it wasn't Chorba? Who else did he see?
Well, Your Honor.
Chorba in Illinois Bone and Joint.
Your Honor, the fact of the matter is claimants receive referrals from a variety of different people. It could be from a family member. It could be from a friend who had treated with a doctor. It could be from an attorney involved in the case. It could be,
and it could also have come from Chorba.
It could have, but Chorba did not document that in his referral. That is not documented in the records from Illinois Bone and Joint Institute. And the key factor is petitioner also offered no testimony. And while your Honor's position regarding the inferences is well accepted, if we look at what the Supreme Court has said regarding inferences, and I would like to encourage this court to take a look at Gold National Batteries Incorporated versus Industrial Commission. It's a 1966 decision of the Supreme Court. It says, however, if there is no substantial evidence to support an award, it is the court's duty to set it aside. So here we've got the commission apparently making an inference that he had been referred by Chorba to Illinois Bone Institute, which is only reported by the third provider, which does not indicate who made the referral and has no supporting testimony from the petitioner. How can that be said to be substantial evidence to support an award as required by the Supreme Court? And because there is no substantial evidence, a respondent requests that this court find that the commission erred and that no rational trier of fact could have found a simple statement to a third physician that a petitioner had been referred by parties yet unknown to a doctor is substantial evidence sufficient to meet his burden of proof under Section 8A of the Act.
Didn't Dr. Chorba say something in his either deposition or somewhere along the record that he would certainly rely on a surgeon for complete or more thorough analysis? And wouldn't that indicate that he had sent him to a surgeon for that purpose?
Not at all, Your Honor, because if Dr. Chorba is a primary care physician, his specialty is not surgery, and simply acknowledging that a surgeon is better suited to talk about surgical issues is the same as if I was to defer to a tax lawyer to talk about taxes. It's just an acknowledgement of the defects in his knowledge. Now, the main issue presented before this commission is the question of average weekly wage. In this case, we have a commission that overturned in a 2-1 decision, a decision of the arbitrator, and basically disregarded the wage records presented at trial to find that the petitioner worked a 40-hour work week. Not only is that a mistake of law, given the fact that the commission outright ignored the plain language of the statute, which requires the use of the actual wage records, it would also be a mistake of fact because there is simply no evidence or testimony anywhere that the petitioner was a full-time employee, that he worked a 40-hour work week. In fact, the wage records presented in this case shows that the petitioner worked 3 weeks. The first week, he worked a total of 18 hours. The second week, he worked a total of 8 hours. The third week, he worked a total of 8 hours. So over that three-week period, the petitioner worked a cumulative total of 32 hours. Yet the commission, in its wisdom, chose to find that the petitioner is a full-time employee, and his proper calculation would not be to use those wage records, but for his hourly rate. I'll give the commission credit. They used his hourly rate from the wage record and multiply that by a 40-hour week. And that is not consistent with Sylvester, let alone the Ricketts decision from this very court. When looking at the question of whether to use weeks and parts thereof analysis, this court, I believe its most recent conversation I could find was Thiel versus Industrial Commission. I'm sorry, Workers' Compensation Commission. It's a 2014 Rule 23 of the decision of this court that said the threshold finding when determining whether the weeks and parts thereof analysis is proper is whether the whether the petitioner has proven the number of days lost from work. In this case, he never testified to any number of days lost from work. What we have here is a petitioner who testified that his exact words is most of the days he would work an 8-hour day. That would be found on page 97 of the record. But it's really pages 100 and page 101 of the record that talks about what he would work. And petitioner testifies that his hours would vary, that he would only work a certain number of hours necessary to get a job done, that his employer would cut number of hours available to the petitioner if there were too many employees, that at the end of the day, he would be told if he needs to come in the next day. And at the end, and only when he comes in the next day would determine how many hours he would actually work. And that would depend on the workload available. None of those facts support the commission's finding that he worked a 40-hour work week.
Was there any historical evidence that there were different seasons where the employees worked more or worked less?
No, petitioner failed to present any evidence of his own in this case. The only documented evidence on the issue of wage came from respondent. It was his actual wage records, which were introduced in the record as page 714. Now, it is respondent's position that this case falls under this court's decision in Ricketts, where this court found that a claimant has the burden of proving that he worked a 40-hour work week, and quite frankly, that there was no presumption of a 40-hour work week. Keep in mind, this petitioner didn't even work 40 hours in the 3 weeks he was employed by my client prior to his injury. There is no evidence presented by the petitioner that he would work a 40-hour work week. The Sylvester decision relied in part on a contract between the employer and the union that mandated a 40-hour work week. If such a contract exists, petitioner didn't present it. I have no evidence. There's nothing in the record to suggest it exists. The only testimony that was presented in the record by the petitioner was at best contradictory amongst itself. Petitioner initially testified he worked 6 weeks from the respondent. His attorney quickly corrected that because the actual wage record showed he didn't work 6 weeks. He then testified again that most of the days he works an 8-hour day. Saying I work most of the days working an 8-hour days is not the same as saying I work a regular 40 or 8-hour day. And it certainly doesn't indicate how many days a week he would work or be scheduled to work. And even if this court was to adopt a typical 8-hour workday for the petitioner, he's still a part-time employee. There is no evidence to suggest he works a full-time schedule, no evidence to suggest he worked a regular 40-hour work week. And as such, the weeks and parts thereof of analysis would not be proper. Like the decision in Ricketts, which was distinguished in Sylvester, this case involves insufficient evidence presented by petitioner to meet his burden of proof. For these reasons, respondent asks that this court set aside the decision of the Illinois Workers' Compensation Commission and reinstate the arbitrator's finding with regard to average weekly wage, as well as to, I see my time is up. Thank you.
Yes, it is. You'll have time in reply, Mr. Wakuzak. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Seidman, you may.
Yes, may it please the court, Steve Seidman on behalf of the petitioner. First, with regard to the two doctor choice rules, there is very substantial evidence in the record. Not only, as Justice Hoffman pointed out, Dr. Peterson stated in his record, so did Dr. Palenkovitz. And the only evidence in the record is a notation in the Suburban records that suggests, and that's Dr. Palenkovic as well as Dr. Peterson, that petitioner had been sent to Dr. Clay IBIJ, that's Illinois Bone and Joint. And the response from the appellant in this situation is that the evidence isn't substantial enough. The only evidence extant in this record is that the petitioner saw Dr. Chorba, who then was referred him to IBIJ and Dr. Clay and Dr. League. And thereafter, petitioner chose his choice second choice with regard to Dr. with Suburban Orthopedics and Dr. Peterson. He also saw Dr. Palenkovic. The notations in the records are extant. The only evidence extant is exactly that. There's no contradictory evidence. And in fact, when I was a young lad, I once asked a doctor, could something else happen? And he said, you know, Mr. Seidman, a cow could jump over the moon. That's not our standard here. Our standard is what evidence exists in the record. And the evidence, the only evidence that exists in the record, is that the two chain or the two doctor rule was indeed complied with. As we all know, a petitioner has the right to go to two doctors of his own choice, and they are referring to. The fact is there are three doctors here, but only two of which, Dr. Chorba, who referred him to IBIJ, and then thereafter, Suburban Orthopedics.
Your opponent is going to question, how do you know it was Chorba that referred him?
Well, the only evidence extant is that. There's no evidence to the contrary, and it gets to a credibility decision.
Well, wait a minute. There is no evidence Chorba referred him. There may be an inference that Chorba referred him, but there is no evidence.
Okay.
Both Plankovich and Peterson merely said sent to or referred to. They never indicated who did the referring.
Well, the burden of proof, I think, was met, because clearly there was no rebuttal from anyone other than to speculate that by the appellant, there was speculation that this gentleman could have been sent by a friend, by his lawyer, is what I think I heard during the argument. And there's absolutely no evidence to rebut the inference even. So the only, and I know, Your Honor, it's evidence that an inference is led from, because that's what we have in the record. And that's what we have in our records, is indeed that this is where this gentleman came from, by virtue of the fact there is no contradictory, no rebuttal evidence. Once the burden of proof is met, it's met. Whether it's an inference, it is based on evidence in the record. With regard to the, and there is a credibility, it seems, and I pointed out in the briefs with regard to that he's that appellant is somehow saying that the credibility of petitioner was somehow impugned. But that decision has obviously left to the commission, and any credibility questions are. With regard to the average weekly wage calculation, I see it differently than appellant. I think this is absolutely a Sylvester type of case. And in fact, we have to take into consideration that this gentleman went for this employco, this employer, at McCormick Place. They set up shows. There are only certain amounts of shows and certain times and periods that they're brought out. And if we look at the plain meaning of the act, as the commission pointed out, the unrebutted testimony was that petitioner worked for Employco for approximately 3 weeks prior to the accident. In that 3 weeks, he worked 32 hours. There were 8 hours deducted.
Counsel, yes. Slogan, we know the facts.
Okay.
Now, I want to make sure that I'm correct in the manner in which the commission calculated that.
Okay.
The commission multiplied the claimant's regular hourly wage of $47.35 by the number of hours, 24, that he was paid at his regular rate of pay in the 3 weeks prior to the accident, to arrive at $1,136.40. The commission found that the only testimony in the evidence were that he worked 8 hour work days. And the commission found that $1,136.40 was the equivalent of 3 working days at his rate of pay. They divided $1,136.40 by 3 to arrive at a daily rate of pay of $378.80, and then multiplied that at 5 to come up with an average weekly wage of $1,894. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Which one of the four methods under Section 10 of the Act does that calculation fall into?
Which one of the four methods under Section 10?
Yeah.
Reading Section 10 says if the injured employee lost 5 or more calendar days during such period, whether or not in the same week, then the earnings for the remainder of such 52 weeks shall be divided by the number of weeks and parts thereof remaining after the time so lost has been deducted.
Now, why don't you look at the third method? Where the employer prior to the injury extended over a period of less than 52 weeks, the employee's earnings during that period are divided by the number of weeks and parts thereof during which he actually earned wages. And tell me why that doesn't apply.
You're saying, and I apologize, Your Honor, I'm just trying to get to the right part of Section 10. It says the compensation shall be computed on the basis of the average weekly wage, which shall mean the actual earnings of the employee in the employment in which he was working at the time of the injury during the period of 52 weeks, ending with the last day of employee's last full period immediately preceding the date of injury. Is that the one?
No, I'm looking at Silvestri setting up four methods for computation. And the third method that's used is when the employee, the employment extended over a period of less than 52 weeks, which clearly is the case here.
Well, yes, it's definitely less than 52 weeks.
Silvestri used the second method it identified for computation, because that was an employee that lost 5 or more calendar days in a 52-week work year. In this particular case, it would occur to me that he falls under number 3. And if he falls under number 3, then by using the 32 weeks, I think it was 32 or 34 weeks that he hours that he actually worked during that 3 week period, you arrive at the exact computation that the arbitrator arrived at.
Well, I would disagree that part of the provision applies. I think Sylvester interprets these provisions to mean that the number of weeks used to calculate the average weekly wage should be found by dividing the number of days worked by 5. And that's precisely what the commission did in this case. So respectfully, Your Honor, I would disagree. When a person works 24 hours over 3 weeks, excluding the 5 days of Section 10 in a plain meaning, says, I think that that's the way it should be done.
How about those extra 8 hours that he worked? You've excluded them in their entirety, haven't you?
Yes, that's correct. That's because it got paid double time. They were for holidays.
You would exclude the bonus portion. You wouldn't exclude the number of hours worked, would you?
No. And in numbers of hours would have been exactly the same if they would have, if they took away or added in the 32, it would be the same, except for those 2 days that got paid double time. So they took away the double time for the 2 days and, of course, made the 34 hours less the eight. That's how they got to the 32 hours less the eight to the 24 hours. So you could add back in those 8 hours per day, the 32 or the 8 hours that the 2 days he worked double time, and or that one day, you would still have the same calculation. Once so again,
do you disagree with the statement that Silvestri stands for the proposition that there are four methods of calculating average weekly wage under Section 10?
I don't disagree with the statement. I don't disagree with the statement. What I respectfully disagree with is, in this case, the fact that this individual worked 24 hours over a 3 week period, and the only evidence is he worked 8 hours a day, get you to the calculation which Sylvester mandates.
How many weeks did the petitioner in Sylvester, did he work a full 52-week year?
I do not believe so. I don't.
Minus a couple of weeks?
I do not believe so. And, you know, I'd like to say that I knew for sure, but I don't know for sure.
Well, I can tell you for sure that Sylvester used what they identified as the second method of calculation. Lose five or more calendar days during the 52-week period prior to the injury or parts thereof. But they identified the third week, the third method. And that's the method where the employment prior to the injury extended over a period of less than 52 weeks. And that clearly is the case here. And so I'm wondering if Silvestri's, your argument based on Silvestri really applies, because it's a different method of calculation.
Well, I believe it does. I think that just because it's a different method of calculation, if you use what the plain meaning of Section 10 says and couple it with Sylvester, you get to the exact analysis that the commission arrived at. Exactly. And if you want to go back to Ricketts and use Ricketts as an example, as I pointed out in the brief, comes to a higher average weekly wage. So given the plain and ordinary meaning of weeks and parts thereof, 3 days constitute 3/7 of a week. Pursuant to the third method set out in Section 10, you could theoretically get under Ricketts 2,655.14, as I pointed on page 16 of the brief. So I would tell you that I believe the plain meaning of Section 10, coupled with the fact that the evidence in this case showed that you worked 24 hours over 3 weeks, 8 hours a day, is within the plain meaning of Sylvester and Section 10. And with that, I will conclude.
Very good.
I have one question. Is there anything in this record that says that he worked a single 8 hour day?
The evidence was that he said was, and I quote, was on most days. Let me, Your Honor, I'll get to the exact quote, but it was on most days he worked an 8 hour day. So that is the evidence in the record, the actual statement that he said, and I'll get you the exact quote. But that was what he had said about his working. He said, however, most of the days that I worked 8 hours a day, that was the actual statement in the record he made.
But that was his statement, not anything produced by the company or the employer. Correct.
In fact, it was unrebutted. And then the wage records from the company indicated the 24 hours, and that's how they got there.
well, at 8 hours a day. I went to law school because there was no math, but there is some math here, so I'm having to use it. If he worked 24 hours, that's 3 days.
Correct. And that's exactly what the commission got. And I, thankfully, I've got a D in college algebra, so it was a disaster for me. But I will tell you that it took me a little while to figure this out, a long while. But he actually, over the three-week period, worked the 24 hours, if you take away the eight for the double time and 32. And then 24 hours divided by eight is three. Then they got to the calculation, as Justice Hoffman pointed out, that's three-fifths or 0.6 of a week. And then the total is $1,800 and some odd dollars after you do five-fifths.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the court?
No math questions.
Well, that's an old saw. Any other questions? Okay, Mr. Robusek, you may reply.
Justice Hutchinson, I appreciate your last question to the petitioner, but again, I would just like to highlight the incompleteness of Mr. Seidman's answer. Petitioner does testify that most of the days he worked in 8 hour days, but that's not his only testimony. His other testimony, again, included that his hours would vary, that he would only work the number of hours to get it done, that he would be told if he'd be needed the next day, and that the number of hours would work would depend on the workload. I implore you to not just limit yourself to page 97 of the record, but also look at his testimony on pages 100 and carrying over to 101. Because to say the petitioner's unrebutted testimony is that he worked an eight-hour day most of the days ignores his own testimony about the times he doesn't work an eight-hour work day. Regardless, petitioner did not present any evidence of a 40-hour work week. And instead, and going to back to the question of the two-physician rule, petitioner seems to imply that respondent has the burden of disproving that which petitioner has failed to prove. The petitioner has not presented any evidence to show a referral from Dr. Chorba to Illinois Bone and Joint Institute. And this court has stated uncooperative testimony that support award for benefits only if a consideration of all facts and evidence and circumstances support that decision. That's what this court said in Gallatin versus Industrial Commission. And it cited Caterpillar versus Industrial Commission, the Supreme Court, for that effect. Here we do not know who provided the referral. It's not in the record. It could have been in the record. And had petitioner got up there and said, I was referred by Dr. Chorba to Illinois Bone and Joint Institute, we wouldn't be having this conversation because that would be enough. But what we've got here is an incomplete statement. And just as a final point, if we were to look at the mileage cases, General Tire, and the cases following General Tire that talk about whether it is reasonable for a petitioner to travel beyond the local area and recover mileage for treating with a physician outside of the local area, this court has recognized that it may be reasonable to do so when a patient chooses to treat with that physician because he had been referred by friend and family. And if this court will recognize that a petitioner can be referred by friend and family in a mileage case, it should absolutely make the same recognition in a case involving the two-physician rule. Thank you.
Any other questions from the court?
No, thank you.
Okay, very good. Thank you, counsel.